Hello, and welcome to the Discographers Podcast. I'll be one of your hosts, Brian, and the other with me is a man who is as portable as he is useful, Tyler.
Thank you. I'm glad you finally noticed how portable I am.
Indeed. So, Tyler, we're doing a special one-off episode this week. Who and what are we talking about?
We're going to talk about the band Tool and their album 10,000 Days.
Now, 10,000 Days came out some 12, 13 years ago at this point.
Correct.
It's interesting that we should choose to do this now, because as it turns out, Tool does have a new record coming out. There's not a definitive release date, but it will be this year. And that's something that we found out after we made the decision to do this episode. But look at us. We're accidentally timely. How hip and happening are we?
We swear we chose this before Maynard started talking about release dates.
Well,
I mean, he's been talking about, we're going to record something in the future. We're going to record something.
And for then, 10 years.
Yeah. So, Brian, we decided to do these two one-off episodes. I picked the last one, AC/DC Back in Black. You chose 10,000 Days. Why the hell did you do this?
Why would I do this? Few reasons. I think one of the first ones is that we had spent so much time with Nine Inch Nails that I wanted to spend a little bit of time digging into something that was similarly complicated, but maybe in a different way, you know, because there's a lot of crossover, and just in terms of how overthought some of their songs are, you know.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of shared fan base as well.
Yeah, the Venn diagram there's got to be pretty close to circular. But oddly enough, Tool is not a band that I had ever really gotten into. They're a band that I, you know, I appreciate very much. I'm aware that they're fantastic at what they do. They're, you know, good instrumentalists, good songwriters, but I just never really spent the time to get into it. Mm-hmm. And I've received much berating from my fellow musicians about that over the years.
You're not into Tool, dude? What's your problem?
Yeah, specifically the keyboard player from the band that I'm currently in. Shout out Mike again. It seemed like a really good excuse to actually dig deep on one of their records and, have a chance to fall in love with it a little.
Yeah. I know for me, I was kind of in the same place, fandom, where it's like, I know of Tool. I enjoyed 10,000 Days as an album, but I never like really got into it. He's just like, oh, there's the, you know, they've got that pot song that's about pot. And, there's a lot of like really long intros to their songs. And like, I think 10,000 Days is the only Tool album that I have in my iTunes, but it's not in rotation a lot and all that stuff. And so I just didn't really, it was there, but I wasn't really familiar with it. And I would like to take you down the little journey the roller coaster ride that I took in preparation for this episode.
Okay.
I went from that, you know, not really crazy into Tool, but I enjoyed 10,000 Days. Mm-hmm. And then I started diving into, and I will say I'm more of a Perfect Circle fan.
That has been my experience as well.
Yeah. So then I started doing research on the band and came across like all the like weird Easter egg kind of things that they do, where it kind of left me feeling like they're being pretentious for no good reason, like just to show off, like, you know, look how smart we are because we know the Fibonacci sequence and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was really dreading recording this and having to talk about this album because it's just like, I'm not going to like this. Like, I'm now less of a Tool fan than I was before after diving into this thing.
I'm so sorry.
And then I started like actually doing some like deeper research into the songs and the lyrics and like figuring things out and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to connect and click. And now I am a bigger fan of this album than I was at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can have a similar, hopefully we people come out as bigger fans or at least understand the band more.
Yeah, maybe appreciate what they have to offer more, because I think that's the gateway to actually enjoying the music, right? Because for me, this was a band that I always had the respect for, but going through the process of taking these songs apart for this podcast has definitely made me appreciate them a whole lot more, to a point where it's actually that I genuinely enjoy their music and may actually take the time to examine some of the other records just for my own my own edification, you know, because I think my next stop is probably to check out Lateralis, because the same chiding keyboard player, Mike, when I was asking him about Tool in preparation for this, referred to the song Lateralis as a triumph of mathematics. And that just sounds like something I need to listen to.
Yeah. So, all right, well, let's go into the history of 10,000 Days. In 2006, the American band Tool released their follow-up to 2001's Lateralis, titled 10,000 Days, and is their fourth album to date. Since 1995, the band's lineup has consisted of James Maynard Keenan on vocals, Adam Jones on guitar, Justin Chancellor on bass guitar, and Danny Carey on drums. Tool often obfuscates the song meanings, and don't always print official song lyrics in their packaging, requiring their fans to interpret and hunt for clues and meanings. For example, in Lateralis, the number of syllables per line in the lyrics correspond to an arrangement of the Fibonacci numbers. The Fibonacci sequence is characterized by the fact that every number after the first two is the sum of the two preceding ones. For example, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144, and so on. The song Jambi from 10,000 Days uses and makes a reference to the common metrical foot, iamb, which is a metrical foot consisting of one short syllable followed by one long syllable, or of one unstressed syllable followed by one stressed syllable. The lyrics on 1996's Anima and Lateralis both focus on philosophy and spirituality. All of this to say, Tool isn't a simple or straightforward rock band. The two most common theories behind the meaning of the title 10,000 Days are a reference to the orbital period of the planet Saturn, actual time period is 10,759 days, which adds up to nearly 29 years. According to Keenan Marks, the time when you were presented with the opportunity to transform from whatever your hang-ups were before, to let the light of knowledge and experience lighten your load, so to speak, and to let go of old patterns and embrace a new life. The other theory is a reference to Keenan's mother, who was paralyzed for 10,000 days before she died. The CD packaging for 10,000 Days consists of a pair of stereoscopic eyeglasses, which can be used to view a series of images inside the booklet in 3D. Alex Gray, who worked on the illustrations for 10,000 Days and Lateralis covers, described 10,000 Days cover as a blazing vision of an infinite grid of godheads during an ayahuasca journey. Gray also stated that the 10,000 Days cover depicts visions received during a DMT trip. 10,000 Days debuted at number 1 on the Billboard 200 chart, was awarded a platinum certification by the RIAA, and had 3 singles. Guitarist Adam Jones received a Grammy Award for Best Recording Package in 2007 as art director for 10,000 Days. As of the beginning of 2019, Tool has yet to release a new album since 10,000 Days. But after more than a decade of hinting of a new release, James Maynard Keenan has tweeted an update about a future album. Quote, "Best ballpark guess? Release date somewhere around mid-May and mid-July."
10,000 Days is vastly more complicated than last month's entry, AC/DC's Back in Black. For that reason, we will take a moment to do a brief review of some of the music theory information that we covered during our first season on Nine Inch Nails. To start off, music is made up of notes. Notes are made up of pitch and rhythm. Pitch is a measure of how high or low a sound is, and rhythm is a measure of a note's duration. The most interesting tactics on this album come from the rhythm, so we're going to look a little bit more closely at that. There are long notes and short notes. An example of a long note would be a whole note. A shorter note than that would be a half note. And as the notes get shorter, the fraction name gets higher. So shorter than that, you have quarter notes, eighth notes, 16th notes, and so on. Now we need to talk about time signatures. A time signature is a way to communicate the timing format of the song, or how it is counted. It is written as a fraction, where the top number indicates the number of beats in one measure, and the bottom number indicates what kind of note equals one beat. The most common time signature is 4/4, which means one measure of music is made up of four quarter notes.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Another common time signature is 3/4, made up of three quarter notes.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
And also 6/8, made up of 6/8 notes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
These three are far and away the most common time signatures in modern music. But this album makes use of a lot of strange time signatures, so it is important to at least have a basic understanding of how they work. So, with all of that out of the way, let's go ahead and sink our teeth into 10,000 Days. The album begins with Vicarious, which begins with a methodical and ominous dance between the bass and the guitar in D minor. This is accented by some gentle rolls on the cymbals and a delicate keyboard riff. This whole section comes to a hold before unleashing the main riff. It is a powerful riff in the 5/4 time signature, meaning that when you feel like it should be done, they add one more beat.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
There are a few different ways to count 5/4, one of which is a group of three and a group of two, as in Dave Brubeck's Take 5.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
Then there is this way, a group of four, and then add one more. This is rather far from the often jazzy context of this time signature, and it's closer to how it was used in Soundgarden's My Wave.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
Although this is more cleverly executed. Lead singer Maynard James Keenan sings most of his lyrics in the verse starting on the second beat of the measure, meaning that the downbeat, in this case the first beat of the measure, is usually accented by a lack of vocals. The pre-chorus uses two measures of 5/4 and then finishes with two measures of 6/4 to break up the pattern a bit and alert you to a coming change.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
The first time this section happens, the change doesn't actually occur, there's just more verse afterward. However, this works as a sort of musical foreshadowing, because the next time the pre-chorus rolls around, it tees up the chorus with two measures of 5/4, one measure of 6/4, and one more of 5/4. The chorus steps into a more familiar but still strange territory by alternating between 3/4 and 4/4. Both of which are familiar and comfortable, but strangely paired together. Mathematically, this song is all over the place, but they have executed it confidently enough that it works anyhow. In the chorus, the melody makes use of a B natural note rather than the usual B flat in the key of D minor, meaning that this section is actually in a D Dorian scale. After a building bridge section, the song revisits its intro before ending with a triplet-laden riff. And this song is actually a great way to demonstrate the concept of triplets, because there are riffs that are played with groups of 2/16th notes, which are then later played with 3/16th note triplets crammed into the same amount of space. This technique is displayed most prominently in this ending riff. Next up, we have Jambi, which is also in D minor, but has a time signature of 9/8. 9/8 is a very strange time signature to Western ears, but in many cultures it's actually quite common, such as in Turkey. One predominant way of counting 9/8 is the Turkish march cadence, and this is to count in three groups of two and one group of three, also heard in Dave Brubeck's Blue Rondo a la Turk.
1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Here, however, in Jambi, it is counted more like three groups of three.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Though that is difficult to hear at first, due to the syncopated start-stop nature of the opening guitar riff. It becomes slightly clearer when the kick drum begins playing a slow, steady pulse beneath the riff, and even clearer when the bass begins playing chord changes every three beats. I cannot stress enough how impressive it is that drummer Danny Carey manages to hold a steady beat beneath what is a very complex and ever-changing rhythm, but he does so incredibly. The song takes a quieter turn with what sounds like an echoey guitar riff, but is actually provided by Justin Chancellor on bass guitar. This is a common occurrence on the record, wherein the bass expands out of the normal role of filling in the low end and basically functions as a second guitar. The song holds steadily in 9/8, cycling through different riffs and sections until the guitar solo kicks in 6/4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
In this solo, guitarist Adam Jones makes use of what is known as a talk box. This is a rather unique guitar effect that takes the idea of a wah pedal up a notch. Where a wah allows you to control the accented frequencies of your guitar with a rocking foot pedal, a talk box runs the sound of your guitar through a vinyl tube which ends up just in front of a microphone. The guitarist then places this tube inside of their mouth and is able to manipulate the sound of the guitar simply by opening and closing their mouth around the tube. It is a legitimately strange contraption, but it does offer a further level of control and expression when compared to a traditional wah pedal. You can also hear this effect used in the Foo Fighters song Generator, as well as many Peter Frampton songs and a surprisingly wide array of artists and genres. After the solo, the song reverts back to 9/8 before coming to an ending which features Maynard singing in the D harmonic minor scale. The next track, Wings for Marie Part 1, starts as more of a soundscape than a song, with some low pulses and a decelerating guitar riff in A minor. It creates a very ominous atmosphere. When a more cohesive rhythm appears, the guitar is playing a series of triplets that each imply a full chord without playing all of the notes of the chord at the same time, which, strangely enough, is a move straight out of the composer Bach's playbook. Or if you want to be pedantic, Bach. This sound is given the treatment of a rotary speaker. This is unsurprisingly a rotating speaker, which when recorded with a pair of stereo microphones, allows the sound to travel left and right in the recording. This can be accomplished with an actual rotary speaker, such as a Leslie cabinet, or digitally with software plugins. I'm not sure which route they used, as the end result would be very similar either way. The intensity of this effect varies throughout the track, but it is present for the majority of the song. After some strangely placed accents from the bass and drums, the song takes a brief and energetic trip into the key of B minor, which eventually works its way back to A minor for a somber ending. Moving on to the sequel, 10,000 Days, Wings Part 2, which opens with a triplet bass riff in A minor again, similar to the guitar part from the previous track, but rolls along with a menacing restraint which hints at an explosion to come. The operative word for the first half of this song, surprisingly, is delicate. The drums and guitar follow the bass and holding back, really making the listener wait for the payoff and letting the vocals take the main focus. This portion is home to quite a few storm sound effects and thunder, which migrate in and out of the mix and provide even more tension. Just about halfway into the song, Maynard really opens up the vocals a bit more. And then the instruments take center stage for quite a while, with the very methodical feedback-laden guitar solo taking front seat, often flirting with the edge of chaos, but never really stepping over. About 8.5 minutes in, the instruments finally cut loose and we're treated to a proper wall of sound. Followed by some riffing in 6-4. The song then takes a strangely familiar journey up to B minor and back. Before another poignant ending. Now for the most recognizable and widely known song on the record.
Who are you to wave your finger? You must have been out your hair.
The Pot.
I hold deep in muddy.
Out of all of the tracks on this album, this is the one where Maynard's vocals are most prominent and audible in the mix. This is a gift, because it is one of his most impressive vocal performances out of the bunch. The vocals are given an interesting production treatment, where the lyrics can be heard at a low volume a few beats before they are heard at full volume, in a sort of bizarre pre-delay. The vocals are joined by a heavily syncopated bass line in D minor, which makes the time signature a little hard to pick out. However, once the verse kicks back in, it finally becomes clear that the song has been in 4-4 the whole time.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
And I love this, because at this point, you're so used to strange time signatures on this record that 4-4 all of a sudden feels surprising and strange, in spite of its commonness. The fact that this is mostly in 4-4 is also probably a large contributing factor to this song's tremendous success. So high, when the bridge arrives, there is, however, a change to 3-4, but it does make its way back before too long.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
There is a great moment where Maynard very much on purpose sings the tritone of the scale, an A-flat, to delightfully unsettling effect. The song takes one more brief turn through 3-4 before reverting to 4-4 again for a truly bombastic ending. It strikes me as funny that this is one of the shorter and simpler songs on this record. However, we must now investigate the actual shortest song on the record. Lipan Conjuring. This one consists mostly of some tribal-sounding vocals and some gentle percussion. It's accented by some use of distortion on some backing vocal tracks. Before the percussion at the end is washed in reverb and then faded out. The next track, Lost Keys, Blame Hoffman, is more or less an intro for the following track, but has a wonderful sense of foreboding on its own. It begins with a droning F-sharp note, which bends up and down and drones around, but it is eventually revealed to be the major third note when a gentle guitar enters underneath with a D5 power chord. This song is basically in a blues scale, being both major and minor whenever it sees fit, occasionally both at the same time. Initially, the guitar alternates between three measures of 4-4 and one measure of 3-4, and later one measure of each, and then alternating between those two patterns. The back half of the song is filled by a skit between a doctor and a nurse, which fits very nicely over this deeply cinematic, brooding track. This then leads directly into Rosetta Stoned. This track is meant to feel disjointed, and it does so exceedingly well. At first, the song mostly uses guitar power chords in D minor, changing in a rapid succession in various patterns, the first of which is in 4-4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The instrumentation opens up a bit for a turn in 5-4 before calming back down into 4-4 for what could be called another verse.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
All of this is happening while a rambling, difficult-to-decipher string of lyrics is delivered at a breakneck pace. We alternate a few times between 5-4 and 4-4 before some sung lyrics help to raise the intensity. We are then given a more dreamy section in 5-4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
which morphs into a more aggressive section, and then gives way to a prolonged engagement in 11-8.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
The song hangs out here for a while, playing with various levels of intensity, ebbing and flowing quite a few times. This eventually becomes a more atmospheric section in regular old 6-8. Next, we have a guitar solo, which rolls over a rhythm section of 5-8, though you could maybe count it as 15-8.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
But after this, it opens up for a fuller section back in 6-8. This is where the song feels most coherent, like a moment of lucidity in a demented mind. We then delve back into a syncopated section in what is most likely 5-4. And then, with a scream, we begin to alternate between 6-8 and 11-8. Before taking a pause and a breath for the outro, which plays out in a crescendo of 5-4. As a side note, this is a whole lot of time signatures to keep track of. I never read the scores or sheet music for any of the songs we review, and I instead pick them apart simply by listening. This usually doesn't present much in the way of trouble, but with a song this complex, it gets very fun very quick. Now, the timing of nearly any song could be counted in more than one way due to the mathematical equivalency of different combinations of notes. So if anybody listening knows of another way to count these sections, that is perfectly valid. With music being as beautifully subjective as it is, you may have a different theoretical explanation than I do. And so long as the math adds up, I'm not wrong, and neither are you. Moving right along to Intention. This one begins with the soundscape that sounds like a factory, which is then joined by a tentative guitar in A minor.
The song properly begins when a strange sliding bass part begins in A Phrygian with a count of 7-4.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
What follows is a masterclass in pushing bass to its extremes. He plays a moving bass arrangement which makes extensive use of harmonics. Now, buckle up here. Harmonics are a technique which can be used on stringed instruments that exploits the physics of the strings and of sound itself. When you hear an instrument play a single note, you primarily are hearing what is known as the fundamental frequency of that note. For example, the open A string of a guitar has a fundamental frequency of around 110 Hz. What you may not realize you are also hearing is a collection of frequencies which are all mathematically related to that frequency. For example, you can also hear the A one octave higher at 220 Hz at the same time as the fundamental, although it very much blends in. On a stringed instrument, you can choose to only hear one of these harmonic frequencies by placing your finger on the string at the physical location that corresponds with that pitch. In the case of the A octave I mentioned before, you can put your finger on the string directly over the 12th fret, without fretting, and then pluck it. The 12th fret is exactly in the middle of the length of the string, so touching it effectively cuts the string in half. Half the length means double the frequency, because physics. In touching the string at this and other mathematically prescribed places, you can coax out a variety of notes that would otherwise be very physically far away from the fretted notes in that area of the fretboard. The use of harmonics in music for stringed instruments is pretty ubiquitous, but it is not often used to the extent that Chancellor displays here, and certainly not on bass guitar. If you want a TLDR on that last section, Justin Chancellor is basically using black magic to conjure notes out of his bass that would be physically impossible to get out of a bass guitar through normal means. It is seriously an unbelievable technical feat. The bass is later joined by a melodic guitar part and some increasingly frenetic electronic drum work. For such a quiet, subdued song, there is a staggering amount of musicianship on display from all involved. The second to last track, Writin' 2, plays through in what is, by this point, a shockingly digestible 11-8, and the key is pretty much D minor, but there are occasional deviations to the E-flat note from the guitar, but they don't really constitute a change to the key. The verses are counted as three groups of three and one group of two.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
But the chorus, still in 11-8, would be more accurately counted as a group of three followed by two groups of four.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is then followed by a solo from Carey on an instrument called a tabla, which I do not know nearly enough about to begin to explain, but it is a percussion instrument. This then escalates into an assertive riff break from both the bass and the guitar. Now, that riff break then makes way for a wad guitar solo, which makes use of different notes and tones on the left and right sides of the recording. But they're played in the same rhythm and timing as each other, giving the impression that it is one guitar making both sounds when it is in fact two separate recordings. This effect has actually been used quite a lot on the record, but it's most prominent here. The song eases its way out to a quiet ending, which leads us to the last track. Viginti Trace. This is a weird one to close the record on, as it is much more of a random collection of rhythmic sounds than it is a song. It is brooding and weird, and overall fits the tone of the record really well, despite feeling distinctly unmusical. It feels more like a supporting texture that was separated from a more cohesive song elsewhere, and as Tyler and I will discuss later, there's probably a good reason for that. Seriously, though, it is a strange move to end an album on what could possibly be thought of as a bad digital acid trip, but this is Tool, and they don't give a fuck. And here we are, at the confusing end of a deeply impressive album. The musicianship is stunning. The songwriting is clever and incisive. The production is immaculate. I can't find any real faults with this album besides it being a bit too weird for some audiences, but that isn't really a fault. It is unique, provocative, and challenging in many ways. And art is meant to be all of those things. I'll admit that it took me more than a decade and starting a podcast to get around to really sitting down with this record and trying to work through its challenging exterior. At the end of it, I feel as though I understand much more about it than I ever thought I would, and I feel greatly enriched for the time I've spent with it. But I also feel that when I return to this record, there will still be new things for me to discover, dissect, and digest. It genuinely is a perplexingly good and complete piece of art.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Now we're going to go track by track on all of these. And we'll talk about the first one here, Vicarious.
This one took a while to grow on me, but it grew hard.
Yeah.
I really wish I'd phrased that differently, but it did. It grew much.
I think this song is definitely interesting. It did take a little bit to grow on me, but it's kind of a good example of Tool's sound.
Mm-hmm. And also sort of the sprawling length of their songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is a radio single that's some 6 minutes long or so.
Right.
Seven, actually.
Do you know off the top of your head if they like short, if there's like a radio version?
I don't know if they did a radio edit for this or not.
But one thing that happens a lot on this album is there's a lot of hidden lyrics or obfuscated lyrics, as you have mentioned before.
Yeah.
This one doesn't really hide anything. Everything's pretty much out in the open. So it seems like the album about experiencing things vicariously, like especially like a TV-focused society. Stare like a junkie at the TV, stare like a zombie at while the mother holds her child, watches him die, hands to the sky crying, why oh why. So, you know, things like war and the world's problems are used for entertainment.
Yeah, the sort of commoditization of tragedy. And I think there's a certain extent to which, keeping in mind that this came out in 2006, this might be decrying reality TV just a little bit. But perhaps only, you know, peripherally. I think this is kind of pointed more at the news, which would not be the first time he had done that. When Perfect Circle did that cover of Imagine by John Lennon, the whole music video was all news clips, and it was, you know, pretty incisive. And I think they were kind of in the same vein.
Yeah, and I know that whole album was all like covers of other bands' protest songs and those kinds of, you know, that was the theme of that album.
I think that when it gets to the bridge section here, though, why can't we just admit it? That's definitely looking into sort of the denial of people who refuse to admit that they're behaving badly, right? Because nobody wants to feel like the villain.
Yeah. And I think that that comes across in several points in this album as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think so. And it's interesting because, as far as I understand it, he kind of wrote this album as a way to process some grief, but it seems like he also had some axes to grind as well.
Yeah, I know that there's, because a lot of the themes are society, problems like Vicarious. And then there's the grief portion where he has lost his mom. And then there's and then it seems like it's, I can't really put my finger out, but like a drug, you know, criticizing anti-drug stuff, you know, with legislation and just that people's opinion of drugs. I think those are the three big things of this album.
Those are definitely same of the, I mean, it's funny because you don't expect a metal band to have some of the more like new age lingo involved, but like it's definitely, it's there pretty consistently throughout the record. It's funny. It's very angry music for very smart hippies.
And I do think it's interesting because we've done a big series on Nine Inch Nails, and there were times where Trent Reznor was, you know, pointing the focus on, you know, political stuff with like Year Zero and, or I guess maybe Starfuckers would be a better comparison to with Vicarious.
Talking about like the vapidity of, is that a word? The vapidness? Hang on,
sure.
Studio audience. We're going to type vapidity into
the
Google.
Was not recorded in front of a studio audience.
Why do I care if it's a real word? Because I care.
We run an important podcast, damn it.
This is a damned important podcast. So what I was getting at was that the correlation between Starfuckers and this is kind of leaning into how vapid celebrity culture can be and how dumb Hollywood can be.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Now that I've interrupted you needlessly for that, please do continue.
I didn't really have much other than just, you know, comparing the two, this band to the other band that we covered in a 10-part series. Both bands kind of touch on the same thing, the same problem in society. And it's just two different approaches.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like, you know, making that comparison, right? A lot of times in earlier Nine Inch Nails, a lot of the blame in songs like this was outward, and then later on it kind of turned more inward, and this one's sort of a little bit of both, if that makes sense. You know, he has a way of like inserting himself into the story of these particular lyrics, but then also kind of pointing the finger with the why can't we just admit it, right? Like he makes it a collective thing. He's not exempting himself from it or calling himself above it, which I appreciate.
Next we have Jambi.
And I don't know if it's Jambi or Jambi or Jambi.
And oh boy, am I scared to say some of the other words that are coming up as song titles because I know they're going to be wrong and I didn't research all of them and I'm just now realizing that.
Yeah, so, well, you know what? We'll get through this together, and for anybody listening, if we did happen to get any of the pronunciations of these song names wrong, please feel free to leave us a comment spelling it out phonetically.
Thank you. I did do research on what I'm going to say Jambi and what Jambi means. And according to my research, it is a province of Indonesia, or it is the numerical value of Jambi in the Kalidian numerology is 9.
And the song is in 9/8, so that's a thing.
Or the numerical value of Jambi in, oh boy, this is a big word, Pythagorean numerology is 8, or it's the genie from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
I'm also seeing another or here that it refers to iambic meter, which is a reference to something that Shakespeare did pretty commonly, where he'd do something called iambic pentameter, where it was a series of syllables that would go down, up, down, up, down, up. So Jambi. So it sounds to me like now, for any English lit majors out there, if I happen to get the order of that wrong, and if it's supposed to be up, down, up, up, down, up, down, I don't know. But
yeah, it could mean a few different things.
Yeah.
And, at least the title, the word Jambi.
I'm going to go ahead and, for my personal music nerd stuff, the one that I select, is it meaning 9 because the song's in 9/8, and it seems the most sensical to me.
Well, I don't play music or do math very well, so I'm going to go with the genie from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Sold to the man with the genie.
But lyrically, it talks about loving someone so much that you would give up all of your worldly possessions not to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
Like the bridge, it talks about the sun shining on two parts so they become one. Mm-hmm. And later he says divided, withering away. And so basically the two pieces are better together than they are apart.
And that sort of continues out towards the outro of the song with the breathe in union, which again mm-hmm. has sort of a new agey flair to it that I wasn't expecting when I was digging into a progressive metal album, but fits nicely. And, you know, it kind of carries through with that narrative. I mean, I don't have a whole lot more to say about this one, except that, as I mentioned, as I'm lying to the audience here, I've not recorded this yet. But as I will mention in the technical analysis, that this, while this is a 9/8, it can be counted a few different ways. And as I was listening through this for, you know, research before we, you know, got down to recording it, I must have gone through three or four different ways of sort of internalizing the rhythm of this song before I found what I was like, oh, this is totally 9/8. It took me a few stops to get there.
Okay.
Because it hides itself. It sort of hides its secrets, so to speak. And it's pretty neat because of that.
Well, let's move on to the next one. Wings for Marie, Part 1. So the plot for Wings for Marie is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I actually want to have everybody... We're going to take a step back in time to in a Perfect Circle album or Perfect Circle song called Mère de Noms is the album from year 2000. And the song is Judith. And the song is Maynard talking about his mom who was paralyzed for years. And she still kept her faith in the God that she believed in. And mm-hmm. Maynard didn't have that same belief. And in the song Judith, he's questioning her faith and her beliefs. And because he says things like, it's not like you killed someone. It's not like you drove a hateful spear into his side. Praise the one who left you broken down and paralyzed. He did it all for you. And then later he said, oh, so many ways for me to show you how the dogma has abandoned you. Pray to your Christ, to your God. Never taste the fruit. Never stray. Never break. Never choke on a lie, even though he's the one who did this all to you. Mm-hmm. You never thought to question why. So that was written in 2000. And then when we fast forward to 2006 for 10,000 Days, his mom has, he wrote Judith while she was still alive, and mm-hmm. then now she has passed away by 2006. And Wings for Marie, parts 1 and 2, are kind of coming back to that, to his, you know, talking about his mom
mm-hmm.
and her faith and what that all means to Maynard.
Mm-hmm. And... You know, as I'm reading through the lyrics of Wings for Marie, Part 1, I'm definitely seeing a little bit of that bitterness lingering, but definitely some more, like, acceptance and...
Yeah, I would definitely say that both of these, there are... Yeah, he's accepted that that is what she chose to believe in, even though he doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Didn't have a life, but surely saved one.
Yes.
Like, oh,
kind of,
man.
Talking about, yeah, her effect on his life and how it influenced him.
That is poignant.
Broken, fell at the hands of those movements that I couldn't see, yet it was you who prayed for me. So what have I done to be the son of an angel? What have I done to be worthy? He's wrestled with how she believed that she would go to a heaven that he can't bring himself to believe in.
It goes back to that whole problem of pain thing, right? That I mentioned in our first ever episode of this show regarding the song Terrible Lie by Nine Inch Nails.
Yes.
Where, you know, he has a hard time reconciling the idea that, you know, the Judeo-Christian God is presented as being all-powerful and all-loving. If this terrible, you know, paralysis happened to his wonderful mother, either God is not all-loving or not all-powerful.
Or doesn't exist at all.
Or doesn't exist, yeah. And, you know, there are plenty of people who have seen their way through that snag, plenty of people who haven't. But, mm-hmm. It seems like he, you know, didn't abandon his position of, you know, perhaps it seems like believing there isn't a God or a heaven, but being able to kind of reconcile the positive effect that it had on his mother's life and the hope that it gave her in her passing time, you know? Yeah, that's a difficult thing to face in art or in life. It's heavy.
But musically, this is pretty mellow.
Compared to the tracks that precede it, yeah, it's definitely the calmest thing yet.
Yeah, we definitely, you know, slow things down. And then we get to Wings for Marie Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
If this is a story, it seems like Maynard has now moved on. You know, he's accepted that is the next step for her is possibly heaven. He's advocating that his mother is the best of humanity, and she, above all others, has a place in heaven, and compares her to people who use religion to raise themselves up rather than
put others down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen to the tales as we all rationalize our way into the arms of the Savior, feigning all the trials and tribulations. None of us have actually been there, not like you. Who could deny you were the one who eliminated your little piece of the divine?
There's a lot. Yeah,
there's more lyrics. There's still tons and tons. Like, 10,000 days in the fire is long enough. You're going home. So that's pretty deep.
Yeah, and that whole 10,000 days, you know, as I'm sure everyone who's read up on this knows, it refers to the time that she was paralyzed, which is nearly 27 years.
So officially there's two explanations for what 10,000 days means.
What's the other one?
So I guess publicly Maynard has said it's a reference to the orbital period of Saturn.
Yeah, which is
adds up to 29.
I think it's 10,756 or something like that.
And I feel like this is kind of just Maynard giving a BS answer, because if this is probably given in an interview, and no one really wants to talk about their mom suffering for 29 years and then dying in an interview. So it's like a BS answer.
Like, cover that lightly.
Yeah, exactly. And then you go on to, you know, oh, okay, so what's your favorite pop song out nowadays? And, you know, you can't, what's the next question after that?
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the end of the interview. I also think that Maynard, in general, across his catalog, has really enjoyed having things have more than one meaning, and so maybe that does mean something to him. Again, leaning into that whole new agey thing, he kind of enjoys the astrological implications of it. Now, granted, I have spent a lot less time watching interviews with Maynard than I have with, you know, the subject of our previous series. So, you know, I'm making, you know, guesses, but
yeah. I feel the same way. It feels like it's kind of an answer that gets him out of that interview question.
Yeah, it's an easy out. It's the longest song on the record, and it really is a journey. It goes quite a few places.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, you know, quite a few different sounds. It's the most sprawling song on the record for sure. The later on in the record we have Rosetta Stone, which is just about as long, but this is a bit more grandiose, right? It's a bit more of a journey. It's almost orchestral in the way that it seems to have different movements.
Definitely, and I will say, in my roller coaster journey that I referenced earlier, it wasn't until I got to these two songs and the connection to Judith I was like, okay, now this is clicking with me. This is, you know, this is more than just songs about, oh, you know, everybody sits in front of TV too much.
Yeah. Kind of a thing. Yeah. It's not just him decrying humanity in its current state.
Yeah. All right. Well, then we'll move on to the next song, The Pot.
I love this song so freaking much.
This was the big one. Like, this is, it wasn't the first single, but it was definitely the big one that I knew about.
Yeah, as far as I know, I think the three singles were Vicarious, Jambi, and The Pot. And they were released in the order of Vicarious, The Pot, Jambi. I think one of the reasons that this is, and it's an easy choice, but it's my favorite song on the record. This is one of the few songs on the record where his vocals are mixed forward of the instruments. And that's a really common old man complaint with modern rock music. It's like, oh, you can't hear what the hell they're saying. But Tool, as a matter of course, mixes the vocals in like another instrument rather than like vocals. Mm-hmm. For most rock and pop music, the vocals are mixed a little bit more forward so that they're more clearly intelligible than what's going on with the instruments. Because for most people who are listening, the vocals are going to carry the most information and the most interest, right?
Right.
And this is the only song in the record where they do it. It's definitely produced to be a single, and it was far and away the most successful single on this record.
Mm-hmm.
But it is just such a good vocal performance from him, and I'm just glad they didn't bury it.
Lyrically, it focuses on liars and hypocrites, and then definitely towards anti-marijuana legislation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff. This is all another part where in my journey where I had to like be Googling lyrics,
mm-hmm,
to like make sure I'm understanding the references.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a pain, but it also forces me to be more interactive with the music.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, I mean, it's frustrating, but then it also, I understand exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And the metaphors and stuff. The line, there's a kangaroo done hung the jury with the innocent.
Referring to kangaroo courts, right?
It's an unofficial court held by a group of people that you're trying to, without good evidence, make them guilty of a crime or misdemeanor.
It's, you know, it's funny because just hearing the word kangaroo out of context in the middle of a metal song.
Yes.
It's really, but for weird, whatever reason, I never second guessed it, you know, because for the longest time, I never even really gave any thought or credence to what the lyrics of this song were. I was just like, this, mm-hmm, song just kicks ass, right? But
yeah, it's the pot calling the kettle black, and that's really, you know, it. And oh, but the pot is also talking about weed.
Yeah, because he loves his multiple meanings.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, further evidence of the strange new agey metalness is Weeping Shades of Cozened Indigo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, cozen is just a heavily unused word for something that's been hidden, like, or, you know, as I like to say, obfuscated, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
But indigo there is referring to a chakra, a particular, yes, chakra. And I forget which one, but I want to say it's the third eye. Now, this is not something I'm particularly well versed in, but I have friends, yeah, who do yoga, so I can speak to this, I guess.
That's as much validation as we need.
Yeah, it's the third eye chakra. It's about awareness, right? So it's like this, mm, hidden awareness, and I don't know if by that he means maybe like cognitive dissonance, like, you know, it's not true, but you're gonna behave as though it is.
Yes.
But like it's a very dense single line of dialogue, you know.
Yeah, you know, got lemon juice up in your eye, and then that's like putting lemon juice in your eye to force fake tears, so you know.
Yeah,
you're acting like you're more emotional about something. The kangaroo be stoned, but yeah, there's a lot of good like double meanings on this song.
In general, it's you know, there's a few other bands that I felt this way about, but the lyrics are not for all of his songs, but like for this one in particular, some of these lyrics seem very straightforward, like very, very straightforward. But then when you dig in, you find the extra layers.
Yes.
And you know, there's a certain degree of restraint in his songwriting. You know, he writes lyrics very differently than a lot of folks, but like when he does the whole line about when you pissed all over my black kettle, right? Mm-hmm. So he went out of his way to avoid using the line calling the kettle black.
Yes.
But he completely got it across.
Yeah, he uses that reference. And like when I said earlier, you know, oh, he's calling the pot the kettle black.
Yeah.
I just assumed he actually said pot calling the kettle black in the song.
Yeah.
Based off of my memory. And I was totally wrong, but he does talk about the piss, you know, pistol for my black kettle. So it gets the meaning across.
Yeah. It's cleverly written. It is. Yeah. It's just a damn good song. And it's, you know, it's funny to think of this one as being like the compact radio single, but it is, you know, still the better part of 6.5 minutes long.
Yes.
But it's one of the shorter songs on the record that is an actual, you know, proper song.
All right. Are you ready to move on to the next one?
Yeah, let's move on to however the hell you pronounce this.
I'm going to say Lip Ann Conjuring.
And I want that to be like Lipan, but I don't know.
All right. So Conjuring, I don't know. I looked up what Lipan or Lipan means, and it's an Apache Native American tribe whose traditional territory included present-day Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and some of the northern Mexican states prior to the 17th century. Many were purged, and the rest were forced out of the United States.
So they were definitely part of that manifested destiny.
Yeah. All we get is the title, and then we get musically... It's this kind of chanting. I don't know what if there's a better way to phrase it.
I think chanting is pretty appropriate.
So it's not really a song, you know, in terms, you know, there's no guitar, bass, drums, you know, all that keyboards, all that stuff. It just kind of, basically, it's just there to make you Google what the title means and then make you feel bad about Manifest Destiny.
Yeah, it's meant to make you think of it. Now, what I don't know is if he actually, you know, did some research on this and, you know, found a traditional piece of music from that you know, that tribe, that people, or what. There is something sort of ancient and otherworldly to the piece. A lot of times I find that when I'm listening through to the record, for whatever reason, that as I'm, you know, listening in my car where I do most of my listening... that I will have finished the pot just before I get to my destination. And then it's usually then when I like leave work, for example, this song that greets me and I'm like, this is not how I want to be eased into the record. It's so challenging and strange, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, it's beautiful in a very strange kind of way. Like it's meant to be very unsettling, but there's a certain art to the way that he put it together.
Exactly. Next, we have Lost Keys, Blame Hoffman. So this is the one where it is a lot of weird sounds, and then the very end, you get this little sketch kind of thing where it's
that
the nurse
leads
and
into
the doctor.
Rosetta Stone. Got it.
Yes. So, it's about the the patient being admitted into the hospital or whatever institution, and kind of it's setting up for Rosetta Stone.
It's funny because it's an intro for an 11 minute song that is as long as a normal song. The intro itself is what, 3.5 minutes, 345, 346,
yeah, something like that. Really long. And then it's just this little, you know, skit. And Hoffman in the title is Albert Hoffman. He's a Swiss scientist known for being the first person to synthesize, ingest, and learn of the psychedelic effects of LSD.
Okay, there we go.
So that's kind of the setup for, you know, if you got problems with the next song, you got to blame Hoffman.
Got it.
I don't know what the lost keys are for. Maybe Maynard just lost his keys and was hoping somebody would find them.
Has anybody seen keys? Has a Cabo San Lucas keychain on it, looking for keys. You know, it's funny. I just typed lost keys into Google, and I got an ad for the Tile.
Maybe that's what he needed. I know Tile wasn't around back then, but you get that little Bluetooth thing you attach to your keys, and you never lose them again.
Well, and my guess is that that's some sort of philosophical reference where people talk about having gone on, you know, an acid trip and, you know, connecting to something that they had lost, right? You know, you know, reaching back to parts of childhood. And I have very little personal context to, you know, sort of understand that. But, you know, it makes sense, you know, thinking about like, oh, you know, I had lost the keys to this part of my brain and this helped me unlock it. Right, is this sort of language you hear from people who've experimented with LSD? So maybe it's that. I don't know.
True. All right. Well, let's dive into Rosetta Stoned.
I'll go ahead and go on record saying, of the songs that are actual songs, least favorite song on the record, but still kind of cool.
I overall, once you know, you have to get dive into the lyrics. You have to read the lyrics because you can't understand the you understand? If you read the lyrics and you understand what is going on in this story, I enjoyed it much better, because otherwise it's just noise. It's you got the guitars, drums, and bass, and then you have the vocals mixed in there, like you were saying before. So it's the vocals aren't vocals. Their vocals are just part of the noise of the music.
Yeah.
So
More so than a lot of the other songs.
Yes.
Yeah, they're just there.
Right. But it was pretty interesting. I think it's kind of funny that, because it seems like by the end of the song, if you believe this guy's trip, happened to this guy was real and not just in his head,
mm-hmm.
aliens came down to Earth to warn him. He's like the chosen one to warn the rest of the Earth about some great, you know, calamity.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so high that he can't remember it, and he mm-hmm. forgot his pen. So now he can't remember what the message is. And that's how humanity is doomed.
And then it ends with goddamn shit the bed.
This is another one where it has a lot of like references that I needed to Google.
Yeah.
When a flaming stealth banana split the sky, the very first UFO sighting in modern history was by Kenneth Arnold in Washington State in 1947. It was originally described as a flying crescent shape, and news organizations reported this unique story, became confused, and the word saucer was introduced, eventually leading people to believe that Mr. Arnold saw a disc instead of the banana shape that he really saw.
Okay, that one's news to me. I dig that.
There's some kind of blue-green Jackie Chan. some of the original reports from the Roswell aircraft crash depicted the crew of the craft as small, off-color. Some reports reported burnt. And being of Asian descent.
Interesting.
And then we had if you're not familiar with the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah.
It's a stone inscribed with three versions of the same decree at Memphis, Egypt in 196 BC. The top and middle texts are in ancient Egyptian using hieroglyphics and Demotic, while the bottom is in ancient Greek. And the decree only has minor differences between the three versions. So the Rosetta Stone proved to be the key in deciphering Egyptian hieroglyphs, thereby opening a window into ancient Egyptian history.
And I like the overlap there with the whole research of Hoffman and all that, where people talk about, again, you know, connecting to something different, right? Unlocking something, and also just the pun on stone and stoned,
which, yeah, I'm sure most people understand Rosetta Stone.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And then this one, so I
really enjoyed 10,000 Days for the journey that it went on, because while it did feel like several separate songs, they all sort of flowed together a little bit better. And I think this one was meant to feel a little bit more disjointed and like the ramblings of a
crazy person. Yeah.
And in that aim, it's very successful. I just don't find it as fun to listen to, right? But it's a piece of art. It's very evocative, and it's well done.
If we want to compare it to Nine Inch Nails, this is the Tool version of The Warning.
Yeah, absolutely.
From Year Zero.
That is a perfect parallel. All
right. So the next song is Intention.
And I do enjoy the title because it's, you know, obviously a bit of a pun there, because it's spelled INTENSION. So it's not intention like my intent. It's tension as in I am tense, but it's kind of both. So he loves him a good double entendre, does Maynard.
Yes. This song seems like it's outlining human history. You got the basic shelter to homes, spark to flame to fire. Forging blades to take things from strangers. The human mind begins pure, and then we use it for evil and selfish acts.
sort of, you know, the philosophical and like sociological version of entropy, right? You know, the tendency of things towards disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a particularly optimistic song.
No, this and the next one I feel like are very similar in terms of what their message is.
Mm-hmm.
So this, it kind of has like a weird intro, almost like it seems like the beginning is very simplistic.
Yeah, it's got a simple thing going on, but it's a weird sound. It's like unsettling notes that he's choosing, right? It's meant mm-hmm. to be sort of uncomfortable, this sort of sad, dark retelling, you know?
Yeah, but also it feels like it kind of, if you ever listen to 2112 by Rush, there's the portion where the main character discovers the guitar,
mm-hmm.
and so the guitar work starts to, you know, it's this person who's never played guitar. He picks up the guitar and it's very basic. And then as he goes along and progresses, the main, you know, the person with the guitar is playing better and better. And mm-hmm. you know, it's, growing. And I feel like the song is kind of doing that too. It's like, this is the, you know, basic early humanity. And then now it's growing and growing. We're traveling through time.
Yeah, and that definitely is kind of laid bare in like the harmonies at the beginning, where it's all these like tight lockstepped, like they feel sort of that I'm going da 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 da, like that movement where they're fourth away from each other. It's got this very like otherworldly sort of ancient feel to it. And then by the end of the song, you've got him playing through on electronic percussion to play the song out. You know, it is, I guess it's a Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, why don't we take a look at Right in Two?
So yeah, this is another one. It's kind of this, it seems like it's a similar idea of judging humanity. It's from the perspective of angels looking down on Earth and humanity. Why did Father give these humans free will? Now they're all confused. Humans fight over land and eventually over sky and water as well. And the angels don't understand why God gave humans earth if they don't deserve it.
Yeah.
It seems like what the meaning of the song is.
And, you know, I guess as sort of like a personal aside, I always really enjoy songs and just in general art that leans into religious imagery,
mm-hmm.
But is clearly written from the perspective of somebody who's not necessarily a participant in that religion.
Yeah.
Right? Because usually it's a unique take on things that I grew up with, right? Things that were set
right.
in stone. I guess I'll take a second here to plug a book, of all things, on our music podcast.
We're not a reading podcast, Brian. We're a listening podcast.
There's a book by Christopher Moore called Lamb.
Okay.
Have you heard of this one, Tyler?
No.
Lamb, the Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal.
Okay.
Biff is just a nickname for a character named Levi, and you know, it's written sort of in retrospect, as an angel has brought this person back to life in modern times and has him sort of write his version of the events of the Gospel.
Okay.
And it's got this, you know, sort of interesting, sacrilegious, but, you know, unique take on a story that's, you know, been played out pretty consistently for thousands of years.
And I'll say I'm still pretty religious. I don't have any problems with people questioning things that mm-hmm. I believe in. I will say that like a lot of going back to, Wings, I feel like Maynard's position where he's asking questions isn't the right mindset for what probably his mom believed in, or at least what I think is the correct thing, or what I believe in.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's still interesting to hear that perspective, and it's okay to poke fun at these things. I, you know, one of my favorite movies is Monty Python's The Life of Brian.
Where, which definitely,
you know, it's a great movie and it's hilarious, and you know, it's not supposed to be, it's not trying to be historically accurate or accurate to what people believe. It's supposed to be funny, and that's the job of that. So you should be questioning what you believe in and questioning things. So I have no problem with Right in Two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a hallmark of somebody who's, you know, practicing religion in a, you know, helpful and responsible way. Because a lot of religious traditions, the thing that I always like to bring up is in Judaism, and granted, I am not Jewish, but this is something that I've always sort of, I've been told about the Jewish faith and found interesting, mm-hmm. Is that a rabbi has their own interpretation of the Torah, of the law, right? Mm-hmm. They have their own way that they you know, live that, what they think each word means, and that interpretation is called their yoke. And then the disciples that study with that rabbi, or who are known as the Talmud, when the time eventually comes for them to become rabbis, they are able to then do their own interpretation, develop their own yoke. And I feel like the idea that that's a religion that is willing to evolve over time is mm-hmm. a really positive thing, right? Because I feel like a lot of the negative things that we see in the world from religions come from people within them stagnating rather than
It's about the rules and what you're doing wrong and making sure you're doing things correct. And it's not about what the religion is probably based on.
Exactly.
If I can give an example that's very vague without naming names.
Looking at you, Westboro Baptist Church. Anyway,
Brian said it, not me.
Yep, it's all right. But
hashtag I agree.
So that was a very heavy discussion that came out of a suite of songs.
All right. Well, do you want to go jump into the last one?
Yeah. Let's
Brian. How do you say this? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Vagina trees.
Correct.
I believe it's Viginti trees. It's Trace. All of this time, I think it was actually misspelled in my iTunes as T-R-E-E-S. Oh. I think it was an autocorrect kind of deal.
Nice.
But yeah, I think Viginti Trace. I want to say that the phrase is in Spanish. I'm going to go to...
It is Latin, Brian, because I wanted to know everything I could know about this song. And oh boy... is there a lot of things that people think about this song?
Talk to me.
So the title is Latin. Yes, it is 23 in Latin.
Okay.
And so on the surface, so music-wise, we'll start with that. It's kind of just a moody instrumental.
Mm-hmm. A lot of weird sounds.
You know, weird sounds in the album. And then, but apparently there's one point where there's like some lyrics and people can't agree on what it's saying. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different, things they hear, they claim they hear.
Much as I'm sure Maynard would have wanted.
Yes. So there's one very clear line that sounds weird. I can't understand what he's saying. But people if you will Google this song and look up lyrics for it, there are like multiple paragraphs of lyrics that are supposedly in the song. And supposedly they translate to one infinity, the horror begins in autumn, this is your trial, which tries your, and then it's power, might, ability, something
efficacy,
along those lines.
Potency, okay.
23 steps to total power.
Interesting.
And a lot of I see the same like explanation of what that paragraph means, that set of lyrics means, copied and pasted in multiple places, like word for word, all that, the explanation for that in several places. And I can't track down where it originated from.
I think specifically with it being 23, it's a reference to chromosomes.
Well, Brian, I went and I looked up a lot of things that 23 references.
Including the movie 23 starring Jim Carrey.
I almost don't want to talk about, bring them up, because there's a lot of things that are pretty, make a lot of sense, like the chromosomes. 2 divided by 3 is 0.6666, six is all the way down.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's a lot of stuff that I see claimed in comments, but I can't find any actual, thing to back it up. 23 is the symbol of new life. Mm-hmm. I can't find any you know, citations for that. You know, Caesar was stabbed 23 times.
There's a lot of numerological traditions around the world. So I'm sure somewhere 23 does mean that. Does mean new
yes.
life. But...
And I don't know about you, but there's a lot of things where, like 23 or 9/11, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you could take any number and then start doing math to it and adding things and taking away things and moving things around, and then you start finding connections to things. And I think that's just the way that numbers are.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of people really read into those things. And I found a huge list of these, this 23 thing. And I think in lieu of an outro song, I want to just record me saying all the different things that 23 could potentially be. Maybe put a weird effect on my voice,
yeah.
But that's just going to be the outro, and it'll just fade out.
Sold to the man with the long list. I do want to back up my point about it being about chromosomes.
Yeah.
Specifically in reference to the song 46 and 2, which came out 10 years before this from Tool. It was on the album Anima. Mm-hmm. But the yes. song has to do with the idea of human evolution, right? So 46 and 2, you have 46 individual chromosomes, and meaning 23 pairs. And then mm-hmm. that's the whole idea, is that somehow the next two chromosomes are, you know, the next step, right? You know, it's kind of this weird combination of, like, you know, biological science and enlightenment. But he mm-hmm. seems to have at least some sort of artistic connection to that. And with the lyrics there being that, you know, like, this is your trial, you know, 23 steps to total power. Right, so like you've yeah. arrived at, you know, humankind or whatever, and that would be my best guess as somebody who's sort of a passing observer to this band and is admittedly plebeian scum.
Good reference. All right, so 10,000 days, final thoughts / the Voltron.
Yeah, why don't we talk about the Voltron before we get to final thoughts? So there are there is a hidden track.
Okay, so yeah, there's a hidden track. You combine three songs in a certain way, and people, I guess, I have a track that somebody made on my iTunes of it.
Me too. And I think we got this from the same download.
Probably the same YouTube.
I didn't realize that it wasn't actually a track for the longest time.
Oh, okay.
I didn't realize it wasn't part of the track listing. And when I say for the longest time, I mean until we started recording tonight and I opened up the Wikipedia article and then realized it wasn't there.
So there's actually some, I don't know, there's a lot of people who say this is, you know, this is the secret song. And then there's a lot of people who disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I feel, because as a non-musician, I listened to somebody's version of it and it sounds pretty darn good. You know, like things line up pretty well. And just for the record, the songs are Viginti Trays and Wings for Marie back to back.
In that
and
order.
Then 10,000 and then 10,000 Days Part 2 on top of those two songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what you get this song where all three of these blend together, supposedly, and make a new song.
And I don't know if it's necessarily so much a new song, but there are moments where the lyrics intertwine with each other, which mm-hmm. is unique. And it's a much more... full arrangement of 10,000 okay. Days. And I actually prefer, rather than listening to Wings Part 1 or Wings Part 2, to
separately.
To listen just to that.
Okay.
Because it's a lot more dense. Now, regardless of whether or not that was intended to be some sort of secret track, at the end of the day, the finished product is that you get to listen to all three of those songs at the same time.
You get to save some time. And if you're not a big fan of how long this it takes to listen to this album without lyrics or something, you can. This is the light version.
Yeah, you can save yourself about 11 minutes.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because I think the band has officially said it's not supposed to be that way. Mm-hmm. That's not supposed to be a thing. But they've also, you know, Maynard has also said that 10,000 days means it's the orbital time of Saturn. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if. They're just, you know, intentionally hiding that or what. Yeah. But so it's, I guess it's up to interpretation, and it doesn't hurt anybody.
Good listening experience, and if you have the chance to listen to it, there's like, you know, a million different people who have put up their version of it on YouTube, right?
Where yeah,
they combine the three songs. Go check it out. It's really good.
Yeah, at least give it a shot. What do you think about this album as a whole, now that we've dissected everything that we can?
It is really ambitious. In some ways, I find it reminds me of like jam bands, like Fish or like Grateful Dead. You know, the overall aesthetic of it is a lot, you know, a lot more abrasive than that. It puts me in mind of songs that are a little bit more, you know, lengthy and jammy like these ones are. It's just these happen to be done in a sort of very precise sort of way. So it's, I guess, Grateful Dead for people who are angrier and really like things to be very nicely in order.
That makes sense. You know, I still enjoy this album. It's nice that I know more about what the songs mean, and I actually went and looked up the lyrics to things like Rosetta Stone, and now I actually understand what's going on and not just mumble, 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 mumble. Good album. I'm not a musician, so I don't understand a lot of the technical achievements that this does in the music, but I will.
There are many. There's a lot of stuff that they really shouldn't get away with that they do. It's a technical masterclass for sure.
But so what do you expect from the new Tool album that's supposed to come out in 2019? Something like this again, or I really don't know what to expect, because
I've had such a casual relationship with this band that, you know, I'd hesitate to really make any predictions, but I definitely think it will be something similarly ambitious, right? I don't think they would have taken, what is it now, approaching 13 years to put out another record and just kind of like, okay guys, here's some songs, fuck off, right?
Yeah. here's 10 pop songs.
I think it'll be something rather grand in scale, otherwise I don't think they would have bothered.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, like I said, I'm a big A Perfect Circle fan, and I hope that it's very different from A Perfect Circle in the same way that Tool albums have always been different from A Perfect Circle, because it's different. It's got the same singer and the same writer of the lyrics, but it's different bands writing the music.
And stylistically, very, very separate. They serve very different purposes.
So I'm definitely very interested in whatever... In 10,000 days, part two, whatever they want, 10,001 days, whatever they want to call it.
Well, I'm also awaiting with bated breath, especially after having gone through these songs, just to, you know, see what happens next. So, to field a question from the audience today, are there any albums or bands that you have had a distant relationship with and then eventually spent more time with and grew to love? Let us know on any of our social media platforms.
Yeah, and I'm going to post that question on Facebook and Twitter so people can respond. And
perhaps you'll give us some ideas for some other stuff we can cover or discuss down the road.
All right, Brian, do you want to talk about an album that is not 10,000 Days really quickly?
I will go ahead and talk about one particular record. In listening to this album, becoming more familiar with Tool, I was reminded of something that had been said to me once upon a time. I used to really enjoy the band Chevelle, a mutual friend of Tyler's and mine named Jeremy, when I showed him Chevelle, said that it reminded him a lot of Tool. And at that point, I hadn't listened to Tool at all. But I was listening to a lot of Chevelle, and I can definitely see the stylistic link there, where Tool was sort of the forebear for a band like Chevelle. And if I was going to recommend one album from Chevelle as sort of a more digestible alternative to Tool, it would probably be This Type of Thinking Could Do Us In, which came out in like 2004 or something in that neighborhood.
Yeah, Chevelle's a great band, and I think that This Type of Thinking is my favorite Chevelle.
I think I'd probably have to agree with that. They've had a couple of really good songs on Venus Sarah, but I think that was, if I had to pick one album from them, it'd be that one.
My pick is very much not in the vein of Tool or even really rock music. Everywhere is Somewhere by Kay Flay.
Okay, well, I love the title.
She is a alternative hip-hop recording artist. And it kind of blends into rock a little bit. If you were going to listen to one track from this to get a feel, I would say Blood in the Cut. It was one of the singles. And, you know, it's just a fun, you know, if you're now kind of depressed from listening to Tool, it's not exactly, happy-go-lucky stuff, but it's, you know, it's more about, you know, oh, man, I like this guy, but I think he's with somebody else kind of stuff.
Okay, got it.
That's my pick. It's from 2017, so pretty recent. So there you go. Everywhere is Somewhere.
I love it. Definitely excited to check it out. We would like to thank you for joining us for the second of our two one-offs in between season one and season two. And with season two on the horizon, we'd like to remind you that we're going to be spending the next few episodes covering the works of Billy Corgan with Smashing Pumpkins.
Yes. These two episodes are kind of like warm-ups. So hopefully we've made all the mistakes in these two episodes where nobody really cares. And the next series will be polished and pristine.
Woot.
So if you want to get a hold of us, our email is discographers@gmail.com.
Our Twitter is @discographerpod.
Our Facebook is facebook.com/discographers.
You can find us on Deezer you can't.
I can probably make that happen. Do people listen to Deezer?
I don't know. You know what? If you do listen to things on Deezer, let us know on one of our other platforms.
Such as patreon.com/thediscographers. Brian, we haven't really talked about it, but I know that we need to make a bigger push for Patreon. Right now, we're getting enough to meet our our operating costs for hosting the show. We're at that level. Mm-hmm. I want to do some more tiers. We've achieved a goal. I want more goals, and pushing towards that. I've really got a itch to scratch in terms of I want to make merch with logos on it. I don't know exactly how much that's going to cost us yet to get to that level, but t-shirts and stickers. I want a discographer mobile.
Let's go crazy. That's the stretch goal, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So for those of you who are Patreons, they're patrons at our Patreon, pardon me, if there are any particular, you know, incentives or tiers that you would like to see, you know, extra content that you'd like from us, give us some ideas. And for those of you who are teetering on the edge of patronship, if there's anything that would convince you, let us know.
Yeah. We're just two guys doing this show. We don't need to run ads because people are helping us out. And hopefully that it means a lot that people are willing to give us money to host a show. And we want to keep that up. And we don't want to be beholden to any advertisers or the man.
Don't want to have to welcome our corporate overlords. Yeah.
Yeah. We are rock and roll. And we don't want to sell out.
And I also want to take a moment, now that we're on the verge of a new season, to echo my sentiments from the end of the first season and just say that we have been absolutely overwhelmed by the response and the amount of people who have actively listened to this show. I don't think either one of us were expecting the sort of listenership that we have received. And we just want to extend a very genuine and heartfelt thank you to all of you for listening to us shoot the shit.
Tell us what you love about the show. So far, we've really only heard good things. So if you want to be that jerk and point out bad things,
that'll help.
You could be the first one.
It'll help us get better.
And it can satisfy your need to be a jerk.
Absolutely. So. Everybody wins.
Exactly. All right. See you next time. And we'll be talking about Smashing Pumpkins.
Have a great time.
2 divided by 3 is 0.66666 forever.
Sweet. Double fractions. Awesome.
23 is the new symbol of life that I cannot find any explanation of. Caesar was stabbed 23 times.
23 times he was stabbed?
Yeah. Only one of them, though, was fatal, which kind of hurts. Someone claims that the circulation of blood through the human body takes 23 seconds. That's false. I looked it up. Don't believe everything you just read on the internet. The number of articulation in the human arm is 23.
Is that from shoulder down to fingertip?
I couldn't find anything that really backs that up. Somebody just said so on the internet. 23 days of the physical cycle in the biorhythm.
It's not lined up to like the lunar cycle or anything. Okay, whatever.
23 is Michael Jordan's jersey number.
True.
The Roman Catholic Church counts on the whole 23 dogmas.
Mm.
23 is a bad movie by Jim Carrey.
Oh, 23 is how old I was the first time that I had to stay home because I'd hurt my back.
I cannot find that on the internet, Brian. I don't believe it.
Well, you need a secondary source. You don't trust me?
Nope. I'm calling your mom. The number 23 is used 14 times in the Bible.
Would have been a lot better if it had been used 23 times. Then it would have been like, okay, now we're talking.
Yeah, exactly. That's a weird fact. The word leprous, dragon, and blasphemy are used 23 times in the Bible.
Okay, that's interesting.
23 is the lowest prime number that consists of consecutive digits.
Why does anybody have that information?
That's what this list is about, Brian.
Okay.
Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species was published in 1859. 1 plus 8 plus 5 plus 9 equals 23. The Hiroshima bomb was dropped at 8:15 a.m. 8 plus 15 equals 23. In the disaster movie Airport, the bomber has seat number 23.
Oh, God.
The number of crosses on Calvary at the end of Monty Python film The Life of Brian is 23. In Die Hard with a Vengeance, the train derails in Subway Station 23.
Okay.
The lead character in the Coen Brothers film The Big Lebowski always used lane 23 at the bowling alley. One of the famous mystery numbers in the show Lost is 23.
Oh, yeah.
9/11 terrorist attacks, 9 plus 11 plus 2 plus 0 plus 0 plus 1 adds up to 23.
I was trying to figure out where their plus 2 came from. I was like, okay, now we're reaching. Oh, okay, I get it.
Kurt Cobain was born in 1967 and died in 1994. 1, 9, 6, 7 add up to 23. 1, 9, 9, 4 adds up to 23.
And he died at the age of 20. Wait, no, 27, sorry.
Princess Leia was held in the detention block AA23. First Morse code transmission, what hath God wrought, was from the Bible passage Numbers 23:23. And those are all of the 23s that I could stand to make a list of. There's more. I just had to stop at some point.
Well, Tyler, I have to ask you, how many entries did you have on that list?
Oh, that would have been perfect. That would have been smart. I'm not tool because I did not do that. All right, maybe I'll edit.
No, you're done fucked up. Good night, everybody.